a series of podcasts brought to you by the Yale Law School. Joel Hyatt, a 1976 graduate of Yale Law School, is the co-founder and chief executive officer of Current Media. In 2005, Hyatt and Al Gore launched Current TV, a new service for young adults with viewer-created content. In this talk, Hyatt discusses the First Amendment and how it played a huge role in his various careers, from his pioneering efforts to create new delivery systems for legal services to his current goal to democratize the delivery of news via television and the internet.
Thank you very much, Harold. It's indeed my pleasure to be back. It's such a joy to have the opportunity to return to Yale Law School. And let me just say, you will, if you don't yet already, you will come to very much appreciate the extraordinary leadership that Harold Coe is providing to this institution and all that he and his vision and his determination and his passion are accomplishing and bringing to it. This has been an amazingly enduring, dynamic, vital institution and way beyond just the confines of American legal education. And it's because the school has had such extraordinary leadership and its deans going back forever. It's a succession, as I said about Harold, when he stepped into very, very large shoes, and he was the kind of person able to fill them, and he has. And the treasures here, of course, start with the incredible faculty this place has always been able to attract, and people like Professor Johnston, who I'm delighted is here today, and so many others. And of course the other treasure is, because of all that the leadership of this institution has done, the very, very best and brightest students come here, and it makes for a very vital and thrilling environment. And so for me, it's just a joy to be back in this space once again. Harold asked in the context of what this particular speaker series is about, that I talk a little bit about my career and how it unfolded, and because I've actually had several careers, something which I have found incredibly enjoyable and stimulating. I've reinvented myself several times. I highly encourage you to think about doing that along the path of your own career. And as I thought about how to discuss my career, I realized that there is very much of a theme associated with everything that I have done, and it's. And it relates to the First Amendment, which I obviously first bumped into when sitting where you are as a student of the Yale Law School, and in its most powerful form, I bumped into it in the moot court competition, where I presented the argument in defense of the constitutionality of a recently enacted a law, and the case wound its way up to the U.S. Supreme Court, a case called Buckley versus Valeo, which challenged the constitutionality of what was then the recently enacted campaign finance reform, a topic as current as today's front page of the New York Times, as some of you already know. At the time, that was a case challenging the prohibitions on the institution by Congress of certain contribution limits and certain trying to address the issue of big money in politics. By the way, back then it turns out it was very small money. The issue has not been successfully addressed. The money in politics has gotten much bigger than 30 years ago when that case was in vogue. But I became very, very interested in the role of the First Amendment and in how it preserves and ensures a dynamic and strong a democratic society. I went from Yale Law School, and that moot court experience in my final year here, I actually went back to Ohio to run a U.S. Senate campaign, and in fact, one that early on was quite pioneering in its use of television commercials. And through that pioneering use of television commercials, we had a stunning upset in Ohio. It was a year that a fellow named Howard Metzenbaum defeated an incumbent sitting U.S. Senator by the name of Robert Taft, the 4th or the 14th or whatever that Taft was. And it just wasn't something that could possibly be done, and we did it. And after that, instead of heading to Washington, I actually headed to New York City and a corporate law firm, Paul Weiss, Rifkin, Wharton, and Garrison, on the theory that I ought to get some training. But I was not there very long. In fact, I was only there a few short months, when on June 1st, 1977, the United States Supreme Court handed down another First Amendment decision, which changed the course of my life for the next 20 years. It was a decision called Osteen versus the State Bar of Arizona. And in that decision, the United States Supreme Court held unconstitutional the prohibitions that existed in all 50 states against lawyer advertising. It was a case in which a young lawyer in Phoenix or Tucson, Arizona, a guy named Van Osteen, he placed this little ad about an inch square, you know, saying he was available to do divorces and wills. Well, Arizona's bar authorities immediately moved to discipline him because, just like all the other states, you couldn't advertise if you were a lawyer. And they were disciplined, and they appealed it to the Arizona Supreme Court, and the Arizona Supreme Court affirmed the discipline and the fact that they had broken the rules governing the practice of law. They appealed to the United States Supreme Court, and the United States Supreme Court reversed, holding that Van Osteen had a constitutionally protected First Amendment right to inform the public of his availability to provide legal services. And that case was an extension of the commercial speech doctrine of the First Amendment. Again, a series of cases out of the U.S. Supreme Court holding that, in fact, the First Amendment freedom of speech doctrine applies not only to the kind of political speech we always associate it with, but indeed to commercial speech as well. And it was in that commercial speech doctrine that it extended its holding to what Van Osteen was doing in Arizona. I was sitting at Paul Weiss, and I'm not exactly sure why the advance the slip opinion of this case came before me within days of when it was handed down. I read it in June of 1977, and I remember this moment very clearly in my little cubbyhole cubicle at Paul Weiss as an associate who'd been there 3 months. And I read the advance, the slip sheet opinion, and realized that this was an opportunity to create an entirely new kind of law firm that would use advertising to inform a large segment of the public who just didn't utilize legal services, you know, people who weren't rich enough to utilize the traditional firms that always serve the affluent, and people who weren't poor enough to qualify for government-funded legal aid. And by the way, as I started to research it, that meant about 70% of the public that fell in the middle there. And it was a way to inform them of the availability of the kinds of legal services that they would need. And I found that a very, very exciting challenge, and left Paul Weiss after only a few months and returned to my hometown of Cleveland and started Hyatt Legal Services, which was founded to provide high-quality, frequently needed personal legal services to middle-income and lower-income individuals and families, and to do so in a way that would make those services conveniently available as well as affordable. So Hyatt Legal Services, again, remember what I said, this all came out of the First Amendment. You know, Hyatt Legal Services, you know, put its offices out in, you know, out or near or in, you know, neighborhood shopping centers, near where middle-income, lower-income people lived and worked, kept the offices open evenings and Saturdays so people didn't have to miss work to see a lawyer. And we pioneered, first law firm in the country to do this, we pioneered the use of standard fees so that people would know in advance how much their legal services would cost, thereby eliminating the fear of the cost, which was the central reason nobody used a lawyer. Now, I could regale you on this subject for quite a while. I'm going to resist the temptation because I actually enjoy doing it. But all you got to do is ask me a question later, and I will regale you a little bit about it.
Can you tell us how much it was to do a will?
My recollection is it was about $55 when we started and went to $75 or something like that. But later on, if we have some time, ask me about how the public interacted with lawyers back in the 1970s and how they were charged and what the whole dynamic of that relationship was. Because the one thing I was sure is that the dynamic between lawyer and client in the real world bore no relation to the high-minded notions I was learning about at Yale Law School about that bond of trust and confidentiality and that. It just bore no relation to that in the real world. I'll come back to that later if we have time. So, and by the way, all that I just said sounds very simple today, but back then it wasn't simple at all. It, in every component of what I talked about, not the least of which was the advertising and marketing, what we were doing was quite revolutionary. And what was the organized bar's response to the U.S. Supreme Court decision in Osteen versus State Bar of Arizona? Most states, what I used to like to say back then is, again, all states now had invalid, unconstitutional prohibitions on lawyer advertising. So they all had to react to Osteen versus State Bar. Most states did something like the following. If your name was Van Osteen, and if you took out a 1-inch by 1-inch square ad, and if you put it in a newspaper, we allow it because we have to. And everything else still isn't allowed. And they looked at the Ed Osteen versus State Bar, the Supreme Court holding. And, you know, as you know, consistent with constitutional adjudication, the Supreme Court limited its holding in that case to the exact facts before it. And what were before it, what was before it, was this little newspaper ad, and it explicitly didn't address any other issues. And by explicitly, I mean it dropped a footnote saying we're not addressing the issues presented by broadcast, you know, television or radio. We're addressing what was before us in this case. It you know, again, that's what they always do, but they dropped an explicit footnote making sure we understood that's what they were doing. And every single bar organization in the country jumped on that to say you can't advertise on television, you can't advertise on radio, you can take these little ads out. And they really, it was unbelievable to me, the state bar's response. I presented the argument to the Ohio Supreme Court. Now, by the way, left Paul Weiss, went back to Cleveland. In about September, we opened Hyatt Legal Services. And in October, I presented the argument to the Ohio Supreme Court that led Ohio to become the first state in the country to, in fact, allow lawyer advertising on television and radio. During that argument, I actually presented an ad that we had produced for Hyatt Legal Services, trying to get the Supreme Court sitting en banc comfortable with what it actually meant to do this kind of advertising. And while I presented the public policy, you know, arguments that, in fact, middle and lower income people got most of their information from TV and not from newspapers, I also obviously argue the constitutional issues, which is you just can't distinguish the applications of principles in Osteen versus State Bar of Arizona. You can't distinguish those principles between newspapers and television and radio. Ohio was the first and quite a while the only state to adopt regulations that allowed lawyer advertising on television and radio. Well, Hyatt Legal Services was born. I'm going to skip over a lot of years. It grew very large because, in fact, our hypothesis was correct, that the vast majority of those people in the middle were completely unserved by the legal profession. And we ended up with, you know, over a couple hundred offices and 1,500 lawyers and, you know, all over the country serving, you know, millions of clients. But I learned a lot about the organized arm of our profession in the early years of our experience at Hyatt Legal Services. And I regret to have to tell you that everything that I learned was very, very disappointing. Here, too, I could regale you with a lot of stories. I'll limit myself to two of the major experiences we had. The first was in Maryland, where the Prince George's County Bar Association moved against Hyatt Legal Services. We had offices in the Maryland suburbs of Washington, D.C., because we had offices throughout the D.C. metro area. And Prince George's County filed discipline against the firm and all of its lawyers in Maryland, and they had three claims. The first is that we were engaged in the unauthorized practice of law because the name Hyatt Legal Services was an improper name in Maryland. I'll come back to that. The second was that we were using standard fees and that was unethical. And it always really bothered me and still does that, of course, you know, that they have these rules, and of course, you violate the rules, you're being unethical. I mean, that's an interesting term that we choose to use. We used standard fees. That was unethical. And the third claim was, get this, the third claim was we had limitations on our practice. There were certain kinds of cases we handled, and there were certain kinds of cases we didn't. So if you walked into Hyatt Legal Services saying you had some invention or something and you wanted to patent it, we'd just say we don't do that kind of law. If you walked into Hyatt Legal Services saying, you know, you think that the grocery stores in Baltimore are conspiring on prices, you know, and you want to sue them, well, we don't do plaintiff's antitrust work. There were lots of things. In fact, there were more things we didn't do than we did. Because what we did do were the frequently needed legal services that middle-income people encounter in their day-to-day life, where we could really develop the expertise, capture economies of scale through both technology and expertise in lots of ways, and pass those savings along by way of reasonable fees. And we limited our practice to serve that market segment. Well, one of the claims in Maryland was it was unethical to do that. Now, I'd only spent a few months at Paul Weiss, but here's what I knew. I knew, first of all, I couldn't bring a divorce into Paul Weiss. They weren't in that business, okay? And worse than that, I couldn't even bring a business matter into Paul Weiss. Because any business I could have brought in would have been a small potato business, right? And they had a new business committee, and unless the bills were going to be, like, really, really high, they had no interest, okay? And I'm being sued in Maryland because we limited our firm's practice to things we were capable to handle. You know, we turn things down because we don't handle these things. We could handle it, but we'd screw it up. I mean, we just commit malpractice. That was unethical in Maryland. So that was the litigation we faced. It was not pretty. Their key witness, I said I'd come back to the same firm name. So their key witness was the chairman of the Unauthorized Practice of Law Committee of the Prince George's County Bar Association. And he's up on the stand, and our attorney says, well, now, sir, are you aware that Maryland has adopted verbatim in its Code of Professional Responsibility the provision in the model rule, the ABA model Code of Professional Responsibility, that allows a law firm to operate in Maryland under the same firm name it uses in other jurisdictions, so long as all the lawyers practicing law in Maryland are licensed and admitted to do so? And lo and behold, and by the way, okay, lo and behold, the guy says, no, I wasn't aware of that. He wasn't aware of the provision, claimed on the witness stand to be unaware of the only provision governing the whole matter of which he's the chairman of the committee. Okay, wasn't aware of that. Next question was, well, are you aware that in fact in Maryland there are lots of law firms that use in its names the names of lawyers not admitted in Maryland because they're Washington, D.C. law firms or they're Virginia law firms or they're New York law firms with a Baltimore office? And he went through a few. No, not aware of that. Well, are you aware that Hyatt Legal Services operates in many jurisdictions under the same name, all of those jurisdictions having the provision that Maryland has, taken word for word from the Model Code of Professional Responsibility, and are you aware of that? No, I'm not aware of that. Well, if you knew that Maryland had this provision, if you knew that there are other law firms, such as blah, 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 who operate in Maryland with a name that does not have in the name a Maryland lawyer, if you knew that all of the lawyers practicing law in the Maryland offices of Hyatt Legal Services were admitted and licensed to do so, would you still have filed this complaint? Yes, I would. You would? Yes, I would. Why is that? Well, the name Hyatt Legal Services just doesn't feel right. Now, we were in front of a judge who, by the way, I believe was far better than the average judge you'd find in this level of court, and we lost in the lower court. We lost in the lower court. Again, I hate to tell you, I hope you're still all very, very idealistic. I hate to tell you this. We lost in the lower court because, you see, that judge lived with the Prince George's County Bar Association. He didn't care much about whatever happened to Hyatt Legal Services, but he sure cared about the power structure of the Prince George's County Bar Association. We lost in the lower court. Now, we did prevail in the Maryland Supreme Court, but understand, if we did not have the resources and the temerity and the guts to put up the fight, they'd have driven us out of business, which was their goal. And by the way, their star witness I already told you about, and our star witness, I'm very proud to tell you, was Professor Jeffrey Hazard of the Yale Law School, who was the author of the Model Code of Professional Responsibility. I wonder how he felt. Well, I know how he felt losing. He thought those local bar guys were all bozos. All right, well, in Buffalo, which was the other one I'm going to mention, but only very, very briefly, I'm only going to mention it because if you think things couldn't get worse, I want you to know that we learned they could get much worse. And here's what they did in Buffalo. Buffalo, you know, the state of New York has these regions of discipline, and they're really an arm of the state. I mean, so it's you know, you have to understand the context. This is the state government now. And after we opened four offices in Buffalo, this disciplinary council for that region subpoenaed every one of our lawyers employed in our Buffalo offices, one by one, sat them down in a little conference room, and said, we're going to proceed against Hyatt Legal Services for the unauthorized practice of law in the state of New York. If you stay employed there, we're going to name you. If you quit, we won't. It was, in every one of our lawyers, it was simply a lawless abuse of power to drive Hyatt Legal Services out of Buffalo, because if no one will work for us, how are we going to stay? So totally forget the due process part of it. We're not going to get to the issues. What we're going to do is make sure no one will work for them. Now, I'm very proud to say that not a single one of our employees quit. And I marvel at that even to this day, because the weight of the state was being brought to bear on their professional license, on their ability to practice law, and not a single one of them succumbed. Now, I'm not pleased to tell you, we lost in the lower court there, too. But again, we prevailed in the high court in New York. But these are amazing stories. So with all that, we continued to innovate at Hyatt Legal Services, undeterred by the fact that the organized arm of our profession was not all that pleased or impressed. We did pioneer the concept of employer-sponsored group legal plans. And we eventually took that concept and spun it off into an entirely separate entity called Hyatt Legal Plans, Inc., as the dean mentioned in his opening remarks. And we did that because what we realized was, you know, we were serving many, many, many people who badly needed legal help. But the reality was this. Even at our very low fees, lower middle income people just did not have the disposable income to pay for legal services. I mean, it didn't matter if a will was $75 or a divorce was, you know, $400 or whatever it was. You know, this was a real hardship for people to pay legal bills. And what we were seeking to figure out how to do is to institutionalize a process whereby hundreds of thousands, and it became millions of people, could gain access to badly needed and very important legal services and legal counseling as a benefit of employment, as a fringe benefit. And we pioneered built the functional equivalent in the legal arena of the HMO and PPO in healthcare. We tried to model it off of the way in the United States of America, unlike, by the way, other industrialized societies, in the United States of America, the way people got healthcare was as a benefit of employment. And we decided to try to model that as being the way people could get legal care. And by the way, there were also bar issues with that. Some states promulgated rules that didn't allow lawyers to participate in group legal plans. But those turned out to not be as severe, and we never actually ended up having to litigate them. And we did create and build the industry. And as Harold said, we sold Hyatt Legal Plans to MetLife in 1997. Today, Hyatt Legal Plans, by the way, and I don't even remember when the stuff was provided to you, Harold, but I actually had dinner with my then partner who succeeded me as CEO at Hyatt Legal Plans. They have over 1,000 corporate clients, including over 100 of the Fortune 500 companies, who are providing to their employees and their families legal services through Hyatt Legal Plans as a fringe benefit of employment. At that point, when we sold Hyatt Legal Plans, I actually left and decided I was going to change my career. And I certainly thought I was done being an entrepreneur. And I spent the next 5 years teaching at Stanford. My first year there, I taught at both the law school and the business school. In the law school, I co-taught a course with Deborah Rohde, who was a contemporary of mine here at Yale and who's on the faculty there. And we taught a course on professional responsibility, legal services for the poor. And at the business school, I started teaching entrepreneurship. I stayed for 4 more years at the business school, quite frankly, because the issues in the law school course I was teaching were at that time very old hat issues to me. I'd been talking about those issues for many, many, many years. And the issues I was addressing in the business school were brand new for me. It was a way for me to think about what were the universalizable principles of my experience as an entrepreneur that you could teach to young, you know, MBA students who aspired to start their own companies. And that was actually something intellectually very challenging because I hadn't thought about it that way before, as opposed to the course I was teaching in the law school where I had thought a lot about it. So selfishly, I continued teaching at the business school. But after the 2000 presidential campaign, in which, as Harold mentioned, I served as the national finance chair for the Democratic Party because my good friend Al Gore asked me to. It is a thankless job and never accept it if it's offered to you. It's just really hard to. But Al Gore and I began a series of conversations about the dysfunctional role of media in American society. And those conversations eventually, over several months, led to our decision to together try to start a new cable satellite television network. Many things appealed to me about the challenge. I never did think I'd go back in the business world. It just wasn't, you know, I did that, you know. But there were a lot of things that appealed to me about the challenge, not the least of which was that I saw in it exactly what so motivated me about Hyatt Legal Services, where what we were trying to do is democratize, small d, the access to legal counseling, because we felt it was really, really important in democracy. And what we wanted to do now with the media was exactly the same thing, democratize and transform the media industry. Al gives a great riff on the history of the media industry, and he likens where it ends up with, you know, broadcast being the most important and powerful medium, the one by which most people get their information. But it really looks like the feudal societies of old. You know, a few big, huge companies controlling in a one-way medium all the information people get. And it really, you know, as opposed to going back to the founding of our nation when everything was based on the written word. And the barriers to entry in a conversation based on the written word are basically literacy. You know, and the barriers to entry in a conversation that's one way on the broadcast media are not penetrable. You just can't get through those barriers. And from that statement are really significant implications for the notion of a public forum and the notion of a marketplace of ideas and the notion of a vibrant democracy. So we founded Current And we pioneered the concept. Now, this goes back 5 years. We only launched Current, you know, on August 1st, 2005, less than 2 years ago. But now I've been working on it for 6 years, actually, now I think about it. And we pioneered the concept of user-generated content. Long before any of you have ever heard of YouTube, it didn't exist. We were out there saying that you could democratize the media by allowing for viewer-created content, something we coined VC squared, viewer-created content. And everything on Current, everything is open to viewer creation and participation. The content that you see, the on-air promos, the ads for our sponsors, absolutely everything. It's open source TV, and what Current is seeking to become is the television homepage of the internet generation. And I'm pleased to say that I think we're making great headway in doing that. But we're a visual medium, and so showing is a lot better than telling. And I'm going to show you a few things briefly. I'm going to show you some cutdowns of what we call pods. The first that you'll see are VC squared pods, viewer created pods. A pod is a short 3 to 7 minute programming feature, and the whole network's based on this concept of pods. It's not appointment viewing like every other television network, 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock. It's a dynamic shuffle. Right now we program 2 hours in advance, and pretty soon we're going to cut that down. A lot of it will actually be live in real time. But it's all short form. It's all nonfiction. It's different than anything that you'll see. You're going to just see some few second cutdowns. You're not going to see anything that's 3 minutes, let alone 7 minutes. You're going to see a few second cutdowns to give you some idea of the breadth of the content that is submitted to us. And I will tell you that on August 1st, 2005, and because of Al Gore's involvement, we got quite a bit of profile. You know, if you'd asked anybody in the media industry, and I do mean anybody, what they thought about this notion that there was going to be this new TV network based on viewer-created content, you would have heard, at the very best, ridicule. I mean, that's at the best. I mean, you would have heard it's completely crazy. And it's not hard to understand why that is. You know, it's a industry that pays absolutely top dollar to get the most creative people in the world. They then, you know, create various forms of programming, of TV shows. In any given season, some network may try to, you know, pilot a dozen of these, on which, by the way, in addition to spending millions of dollars to creative geniuses, they then spend tens of millions of dollars on research to make sure the public's going to like these things. And then they launch a new season of 12 shows, and in a good season, one of them makes it. Now, in fairness to these people, if you went to them and said, these guys are going to have John Q. Citizen create television, you can understand why they just break out laughing, right? Of course, they didn't get what we were talking about at all, maybe because it's a visual medium and you have to see it to understand it. But 3 or 4 weeks after we launched Current TV, Katrina hit New Orleans. And while the entire world's News Corp was down in Louisiana trying to get to New Orleans, but of course safety forces wouldn't let them in New Orleans, and there wasn't a New Orleans in the first couple of weeks, by the way, it was a lake. You know, trying to get there so they could inform as to what was happening. You know, I remember, well, Anderson Cooper was, you know, way up, you know, 50 miles from New Orleans, and he's standing outside and it's raining, you know, his typical style. It's still raining down here, and we're told that in New Orleans, you know, and that was what was happening in New Orleans. You know, Anderson Cooper making it up from people he could try to get on the phone somewhere. Well, a 24-year-old young man was out on his flat-bottom boat in what used to be New Orleans, rescuing people, taking his video camera along, submitting the footage to us, which in real time we have up on the air, and this is what is happening in New Orleans. And that was the first signal people had that there was some power to this whole notion of citizen journalism. You'll see a little cut down from that. You'll also see a cut down that involves a band called The Shins, and what you'll be seeing is what became the first audience-created music video. And you'll see at the end one of our viewer-created ads, again, something we totally pioneered. It's an ad that was made for Toyota, one of our sponsors. The piece from the Gaza Strip was sent to us by that young man. Again, by the way, the World Press Corps was kept by the Israeli Defense Forces around a rope line, and part of that pod, he actually took some film of hundreds of reporters, you know, several hundred yards away being kept out of that synagogue by Israeli Defense Forces. He, as he started off, if you caught it, I snuck into the synagogue, you know. That's exactly right. He snuck into the synagogue. That film was, while that was when Israel was disengaging from the Gaza Strip, and it was the subject of 3 days of massive news attention, but only we had on the air something from inside like that. And he sent it to us using Instant Messenger. He IM'd the video to us. He called in and said he had it real time. How could he get it to us? And we explained to him how to compress the video and get it to us with using Instant Messenger. And we realized, Al and I, years ago when we started the conversation, we realized the potential of the revolution in digital video technology to enable a global conversation among what is the first truly global generation, because that's what your generation is. It is the first truly global generation. And for the internet is for us where that conversation takes place at current. If you're a content creator, you know, we provide a virtual studio. Just like, you know, film houses and television have, our studio is virtually available for content creators all over the world, where you can be in touch with our creative executives, where it's an open door for new talent. That's where you submit your video into the online studio. It's also where we have an online training program that is the best training you'll find anywhere in the world, and it is absolutely free. And no matter what your skill level is, you can learn a lot about storytelling and about shooting and sound and lighting and editing and compression and everything you need to know to participate in this global conversation. We also rely on our users to help us program the network. So our community views and vets the videos submitted into the online studio, greenlights their favorite, votes for their favorite, and the very best get on air, and provides lots of comments to producers that help them improve their work. And it's because of this involvement by our community in programming the network that Current stays authentic and stays relevant and very closely connected to our audience's interests and their tastes. They are determining, you know, how the issues unfold. We seed that conversation with our own young, talented, in-house, what we call Vanguard Journalism Unit. I will tell you that one of the other many pieces of conventional wisdom that was told to us with great strength and conviction is that young adults don't care about the news. And if they care about the news, they certainly don't watch it on you know, TV news. And you know, we knew that all the research proved that was right, but we just didn't understand why people didn't see what that was all about. I mean, why should young adults watch the news? I mean, when I grew up watching, it was Walter Cronkite on CBS. And he ended every single night with a phrase probably none of you have ever heard. Professor Johnson will confirm this. He ended every single night with, "And that's the way it is." Tuesday, September 26, 1964. This is Walter Cronkite, CBS News. Good night. "And that's the way it is." If I said to my 23 and 20-year-old sons, "And that's the way it is," they would think I'd drop down from Mars. That's the way it is, because some old guy in a white shirt and a tie, that's the way, there's no other way. And by the way, nothing has changed. Yes, it went from Walter Cronkite to Dan Rather for the next 20-year period. And now they're trying Katie Couric, not very successfully, but they are. But the point is, nothing's changed. Not the real estate of the screen, not the authoritative one way, that's the way it is. They don't have the line, "That's the way it is," but that's how the news plays. Why would you watch that? You don't, and you wouldn't. But that didn't say to us that young people don't care about the issues. And so what we did is we just reinvented the form. I mean, our Vanguard journalists go out all over the world, you know, telling stories no one else is telling them. They tell them from their own perspective, in their own voice, and telling what it means to them and to their generation. And the audience response is just unbelievably, overwhelmingly positive and powerful. And I'm going to share, this will be even shorter than last time, just a few cut downs of some of the things that our Vanguard journalists are doing. But the First Amendment, that thing that I sort of started exploring when I was here and seems to be a theme throughout my career, plays a huge role in all of this too. Broadcasters are protected by the First Amendment, and my thesis is that the Founding Fathers would be stunned, just stunned, to see that what they intended by the First Amendment today protects NBC and ABC and CBS. I think they would find unrecognizable the place to which that doctrine has arrived. As you know, the First Amendment was promulgated to protect the press from encroachment, from intimidation by government, so that the press could itself be a check and balance in our constitutional system. It could be that fourth estate. But today, broadcast industry is an oligopoly. It is virtually impossible. It is impossible to enter, and that extends as well to cable and satellite television, the business that we're in. And when we started, You know, everyone in the industry we talked to, no exceptions. And we talked to lots of people. Everyone in the industry we talked to said, listen, that's a great concept, you know, viewer-created content, democratize the media, that's the digital technology revolution, that's all wonderful stuff, Al, all wonderful stuff, Joel, but you guys can't start a cable satellite television now. That's the part you don't get. Now, as an old-fashioned entrepreneur, that just got my juices flowing. You know, they tell me it's impossible, good, I found my next challenge, what the hell. Turns out, by the way, and I don't have time for this, it turns out they were completely right, it is impossible, and how we finesse that reality, that absolute fact, is a separate speech and a separate story, usually better told over drinks, but it is impossible. But here's the point I want to make. What are the public responsibilities that broadcasters are fulfilling today in exchange for the First Amendment protections they receive? And my answer to that is none. And I realize that's sort of harsh, but my answer to that is none. And I just, there's just so much evidence of this, but let me just give you one sort of example, it's all it is, an example of why I reached the conclusion none. And that is because 2 years after 9/11, 2 years after 9/11, 70%, that's 7-0, 70% of the American public believed that Saddam Hussein was responsible. What possible role could the press in the United States be playing? What possible positive role could the press be playing if 70% of the American people 2 years after 9/11 thought Saddam Hussein responsible? By the way, a majority thought all the hijackers of planes were Iraqi when not a single one was. So I'd ask you to think about that. I'd also ask you to think about political coverage. I believe, all of us at Current believe, that the role of the media in political coverage has completely failed the public. It's certainly failed young adults, but it has completely failed the public and failed American democracy. And by the way, simple reason, politics today is a very big business, and the foundation of the big business of the politics industry is big media. Big media salivates, particularly every 4 years. Every 2 years is good for them, but every 4 years when presidential campaigns come along, salivates over the amount of money it makes on selling those 30-second ads. It is now, it'll be well over $1 billion this year. It was over $1 billion last cycle. And that's a lot of money, and they make the money selling the ads. Think also about what passes for punditry. You know, you watch punditry, you know, the commentators on broadcast covering public issues. The vast majority of the time, what passes for experts are hired guns who have been paid to show up and express a point of view designed to manipulate your thinking on the issue at hand. James Carville is an expert on Sunday morning talk shows. James Carville, no one says, by the way, we want you to know James Carville last year made $6 million on behalf of the following special interests who are still paying him, and the views he expresses now are part of what he's being paid to express. No one says that. And by the way, if James Carville's bad, his wife Mary Madeline's much worse. it's a paid industry of people who the Sunday shows go to, and they sit there. Expert on an issue? Oh, come on. First of all, they're not experts on the issue. They don't care about the issue. They are experts on a point of view for which they are paid to express an opinion to you on that Sunday show designed to influence your thinking to achieve an outcome for a very narrow special interest. And they've all gotten quite rich doing it. And this is what passes for punditry on broadcast. I don't want to use the journalism because I'll come in a moment to the fact that I don't think it is journalism. And finally, as you all know, the political coverage is all about the horse race and the haircuts, and very rarely about the issues. And the result, by the way, as this gets worse and worse, as the industry of politics has gotten bigger and bigger, the dollars more and more, the punditry more strident and not expert-driven, but dollars-driven, and the horse race coverage ever more extensive than the issue coverage, what's been the result? Political participation in America has gone down and down and down and down, and we have an completely uninformed citizenry today. An uninformed citizenry with a form of government that depends on an informed citizenry. Not a pretty picture. And I would say to you that the journalism profession, which has played such a storied role, with, by the way, many of the graduates from this institution being players in that storied role, which has had such an incredibly important impact on our country over the years, I don't think there is a journalism profession today. Journalism profession became the news business. And the news business morphed into the media industry, and that's now all owned by conglomerates. And By the way, there is a business purpose to why GE owns NBC News. And it's not the impact on GE's financial statements of the NBC News unit, which is too small to even be reported as a separate unit. It's just a small unit within NBC itself. And yeah, they hammer those guys to make money. They don't, even still, they don't want that unit losing money. But there's an important benefit. Because when one of GE's other businesses, you know, wants to get a waiver to sell jet engines to China or whatever it wants to do that day, owning NBC News, you know, that reports on government and on presidents and on executive branches and on Congress, that's a really useful tool to have. And that's the role it plays in American society, all part of advancing big business's agenda, which again, whether you agree with that agenda or not, isn't really the issue here. It's whether is this what the founders had in mind of providing First Amendment constitutional protection for. That's the issue I'd like to bring to your attention. Now, how do we go about fixing all of this? Well, first of all, in my bringing it up to you, it's my hope that you will think about addressing these issues because they really, really do matter. You know, at Current TV, we're going to try to cover the 2008 election very differently. First of all, we are not going to accept any paid political ads. So we're going to forego our share of that, of feeding at the trough on that. Secondly, we're going to replace hired gun punditry with popular participation. And we're going to provide all kinds of tools for that, for our viewers to make mashups, for them to become involved in viewer-created ads on issues, not on candidates' hairdos or whatever, but on issues. We're going to have a debate process that, again, involves people expounding views on issues, debating opposing points of views in a process that we hope will create some traction and some interest. We're going to try to create a public forum in video format. We're going to have our Vanguard journalism unit do what we hope will be very compelling and important and informative pieces on the issues. And we're going to give candidates airtime, but the candidates are going to have to show up and use the airtime the way our own journalists use the airtime. They're going to have to do it themselves. You know, we're not going to take their ads for pay or not for pay. And they're going to have to show up and talk those issues in formats that are participative with our viewers and using our model of how we're trying to democratize and transform the process. We'll challenge all the other networks to do the same. None of them will do so. None of them will do so because there's just too much money at stake. And I believe, as I did when I argued Buckley versus Vallejo down the hall here, that we have to strip big money out of the political process. And it's much worse today than 30 years ago when I argued it here. And we must not be dependent on ads for our information. And we must engage the citizenry on issues. And we must redefine the public purpose justifying First Amendment protection for broadcast television. And we must open up participation and recreate a public forum or a marketplace for ideas where civil discussion over important issues can take place and the best ideas rise on the merits. And I believe the future of American democracy depends on our figuring out how to do that. And I hope that some of you will tackle these critically important issues and seize the challenges and, by the way, the opportunities that come from these and that are presented by them. And this institution has had an amazing history of getting young people like you to see in this pathways for your own careers. And that would be my most fervent hope that some of you will do just that. Thank you very much.